Welcome to Inside the New York Times Book Review. I'm Sam Tannenhaus. This week, novelist and critic Dale Peck describes the unusual, remarkable career of Austrian novelist Thomas Bernhard.
Germans saw him, I think, maybe in the way that we now see Sebald, as this articulator of this immense guilt felt by the post-war generation for what their predecessors had done.
Julie Bosman has notes from the field. The Times' Neil Genslinger discusses the art of humor.
He doesn't seem to get satire as a form of humor, and he certainly, you can't imagine him watching television today and laughing at a lot of what's on there. Jon Stewart, I'm guessing, would just completely go over his head.
And Jennifer Schussler has bestseller news. All that after this break.
This episode of the Book Review Podcast is brought to you by Ford and Voice Activated Sync, the in-car connectivity and entertainment system that features music search with the sound of your voice.
Thomas Bernhard died 21 years ago, but he remains a major literary figure. There are two new books of his called My Prizes and Accounting, and then Prose, a collection of short stories. They're both reviewed first by Dale Peck on our cover, who's here to talk about this most unusual author. Welcome, Dale.
Thank you.
First, for our listeners who aren't familiar with Bernhard, briefly, who was he?
He was an Austrian writer born shortly before the beginning of World War II and died in 1989, 21 years ago. Extraordinarily prolific. He trained actually as an actor and a musician for much of his life, but he battled tuberculosis his entire life. And when it finally became clear that he didn't have the stamina to perform on stage or the skill to play the piano on stage, he switched to writing relatively late and produced an enormous number of plays and about a dozen novels and a five-volume memoir. He first kind of reached a vogue here with a book called Wittgenstein's Nephew about his time in a tuberculosis sanatorium that was right next to an insane asylum where Paul Wittgenstein, the nephew of the famous philosopher, was staying, and they struck up a friendship that lasted until Paul Wittgenstein committed suicide, if I remember correctly. But he's best known, I think, for among aficionados for the last four novels he wrote, which are The Loser, a book about music, and particularly a character who's probably based on Glenn Gould, with whom Bernhard studied music, a book called Woodcutters, which is about the theater and particularly centers around the suicide of a childhood love of Bernhard's, which caused a huge scandal in Austria when it was published because all the figures were recognizable from the Austrian theater. Then Extinction, which is a book essentially about publishing, about a very wealthy man who decides to endow a small publisher as his way of sort of making good for all the evil things that Austria did during the war. And then he wrote Extinction, and he was at the time thought he was dying and had a little reprieve, and so he whittled out one last little book called Old Masters, which is about painting. There's a Bernhard scholar slash biographer called Gita Honegger who refers to it as a classical Greek trilogy with the Seder play attached, which I think is a really good way to look at it. It sort of sums up everything that he thinks about the various arts and the relationship to the state.
Why is he so major a figure, and yet, as you suggest, not even as recognized as he ought to be?
The second part of the question is the hard answer. I think that the first part's really easy. In the review, I talk about essentially what I see as two strains of literature. One's very popular, one's democratic, one's about inclusion, one's about, you know, new voices and representation and everything else. It's the one that, you know, myself and virtually every other writer I know belongs to. And then there's this other tradition, which is this tradition of alienation, of Weltschmerz. It's in just incredible isolation. And we think of Dostoevsky, we think of Tristram Shandy. And in the 20th century, it's Kafka, Beckett, Bernhard. And as far as I can tell, no one's really kind of stepped up to the plate after that. I mean, it's a very singular tradition. It's the tradition that sort of punches holes in all of those, you know, redemptive qualities that nice liberal writers like myself like to see, you know, in fiction, in art in general.
Is there, I mean, an authentic misanthropy in what he does? Is this a guy who really hated being human, hated being alive, or is this a literary pose?
Well, I don't think there was any misanthropy at all. I mean, not even in the books. What he hated was institutions. What he hated was the idea of state-sanctioned art or even state-sanctioned behavior. I mean, the thing that drew me to the novels always was this incredible connection, you know, that one character attempts to make with another character. And I think that one of the things that sort of marks him as distinct, possibly, you know, from the writers who come before him is that they always did make that connection. You know, there's always that one-to-one relationship, and very often it centers around love, but also it can be just a chance encounter. Bernhard himself famously lived with a woman for well over 30 years. She supported him in his early years when he had no money. He was absolutely heartbroken when she died. His last novel, Old Masters, which he himself wrote on a kind of reprieve from death. He had finished Extinction, thought he was going to die, kind of hung on for another year and a half and wrote this last beautiful book, which was essentially about an old man, the love of whose life has died. And there's always that connection in there. But what he hated was this idea of any kind of state control over the way people think, the way people express themselves, the way people relate to one another. I mean, this is someone who was born, I think, in 1939. And so, you know, I mean, his childhood was the war years, being shuttled back and forth between an annexed Austria into Germany, bouncing around from different families, growing up in the post-war years in sort of incredible poverty. And, you know, Austria, very different from Germany. Nazism held out there for a lot longer and underground. And then on top of that, there's Catholicism. In his memoirs, you know, he says that there's no difference whatsoever between Austrian Catholicism and Austrian Nazism. To him, it's just two different forms of mind control, of body control, and everything. And so it's always this absolute freedom, you know, but always that freedom runs up against his idea of isolation, and he goes running after somebody, both physically, but also in the form of some kind of expression as well, artistic expression.
How is he viewed today in Austria, and how was he viewed during the peak of his literary productivity?
I don't know any Austrian writers. The German writers I know worship him, but they worship him mostly for his plays, which haven't really been performed that often here. I've actually never read one of the plays. I mean, I think partly because I'm a novelist and I have that bias towards the novel, partly because I'm so in love with the novel and with his novels, and I don't know much about theater, and I'm afraid I won't get them, and I don't want anything to tarnish my sort of image of him, so I shy away from them. When they're performed, if they're ever performed, I want to go see them live because I think that's the way that they're meant to be experienced. But as a linguist, I think he was very well respected. But I think as a articulator of a particular point of view, you know, Germans saw him, I think, maybe in the way that we now see Sebald, as this articulator of this immense guilt felt by the post-war generation for what their predecessors had done. And you know, that's what we see in The Emigrants. That's what we see in Austerlitz a lot. I think that he was doing that there in Germany, you know, or in Austria rather, for them. And, you know, the newspapers love to hate him, but that hatred only seemed to make him more popular. People bought his books in droves and wanted to know everything. He sort of famously alienated virtually everyone that he was ever close with, except for this, you know, one woman with whom he spent his entire life. But it never really turned, you know, the Austrians off. When in his will, he very famously said that none of his plays or his novels could ever be published or performed in Austria again, there was actually a huge outcry, and for better or worse, the stipulation in the will was overturned, and the books are available in Austria, and the plays are still performed. It's hard to say how much of that was opposed. He was very good at making fun of his own curmudgeonliness and all that, but at the same time, you know, the anger was very real. What I like about it is the fact that there was always that distinction between institutions and people. You never see him get mad at people specifically. You see him get exasperated sometimes at people doing self-stymieing things, but almost always it's the narrators of the books, the Bernhard, you know, stand-ins. But it's the church, it's the state, you know, it's cultural organizations. Those are the things that he saves his anger for.
Well, Dale, you mentioned cultural organizations. One of the books is called My Prizes. Was he actually honored and esteemed? And
I don't know how many prizes are available for German language writers, but he seems to have gotten every one of them, and he got them all in about 5 or 10 years. And they were fairly big awards. They just kind of rolled in on him. Most of them were for Frost, for Gargoyles, for the Limeworks, very early works of his in the 60s and 70s, before his reputation had really been established. And, you know, as he describes it in the book, he sort of makes fun of the whole process. You know, he makes fun of the people who give the prizes. He makes fun of himself for accepting the prizes. He's always in debt because when he wins the prizes, he spends them immediately on a new house, a new car, new storm windows for the house. It's all kind of ridiculous. And then there's finally this sort of big show when he says, no, I'm not going to take any more prizes. And it just happens to coincide kind of when his books were starting to become big successes and his plays were being performed all over and he didn't really need the money anymore. So, you know, I think it's very much someone who knows Bernhard, Bernhard's work will appreciate it a lot. Someone who doesn't know Bernhard will say, this this guy's a kind of a bit of a poser, which he certainly was. But, you know, I think he backs up the pose in the other books.
Thanks a lot, Dale.
Thank you.
That's Dale Peck, who this week reviews two books by Thomas Bernhard, My Prizes in Accounting and Prose, on the cover of this week's book review. Julie Bosman's here with Notes from the Field. Hi, Julie.
Hi, Sam.
So, General or former General Stanley McChrystal has something to say.
Yes, he's going to have his say in a new memoir, which was announced on Wednesday, and it's going to be published by Portfolio, which is an imprint of Penguin. It doesn't have a title yet, but it will come out in 2012. And the book was described as a leadership memoir. It will talk about his long career in the military, among other things.
Julie, Stanley McChrystal was involved in some controversy involving the White House a while back. Is that something he's going to get into as far as we know?
I'm told that he will get into it. Of course, it seems like a long time ago now, but this summer McChrystal was fired by President Obama after a Rolling Stone article by Michael Hastings was published, which quoted anonymously many of McChrystal's aides making disparaging remarks about Obama, about Vice President Biden and their staff. So Portfolio did say that the general will cover it in the proper context, but we don't know into how much detail he will go.
Now, Julie, not to leap into the world of ideological presumption, but Portfolio has a reputation of being a conservative publisher. Is that right?
It is. They publish a lot of conservative and business-oriented books, which is becoming a slightly more popular thing in publishing these days. Penguin, of course, is just like other publishing houses, and that probably leans left, but this is the slightly right-wing portion of Penguin.
Thanks a lot, Julie.
Thanks, Sam.
A not very funny new book on humor. Neil Genslinger fills us in after this break.
This episode of the Book Review Podcast is brought to you by Ford and Voice Activated Sync, the in-car connectivity and entertainment system that features music search with the sound of your voice. When you have Sync, you can simply say the name of a song, band, artist, or genre of music on your MP3 player to browse and play the music you want to hear. You can also use the controls included in your vehicle's sound system to control most MP3 players. Sync is subscription-free, and it's available exclusively on Ford, Lincoln, and Mercury vehicles. For more details, visit SyncMyRidePodcast.com.
Paul Johnson is a distinguished British journalist and historian who's written about many subjects, and now he's taken his hand at humor. It's a new book called Humorists, From Hogarth to Noel Coward. It's reviewed for us by one of our favorite reviewers, also a very funny man himself, Neil Genslinger, who's here to talk about it. Hi, Neil.
Hello.
Does Paul Johnson have much to say about humor? Or let me put it another way. What does Paul Johnson have to say about humor?
Well, about the art of humor, not an awful lot. He's given us a dozen or so mini biographies of some people he thinks were important in the history of humor. He doesn't talk a lot about what makes them funny or the impact they had in their day or the impact they still have today. The book's a little disappointing in that regard, but some perfectly nice, serviceable mini biographies of people like W.C. Fields, Charlie Chaplin, the Marx Brothers, and a few that you probably would not expect, a couple of artists like Rowlandson and Toulouse-Lautrec is in here.
He calls Toulouse-Lautrec a humorist?
Yes, he does. The parameters of his definition of humor are only become clear gradually as you go through. He seems to like bawdiness. He seems to gravitate towards humorous with interesting personal lives that involved a lot of sex and adultery and so on. But when it comes down to it, he being a conservative historian, he actually has a fairly conservative definition of humor, at least as I took it from the book. He likes Noel Coward is in here, and he likes that type of humor, the sort of gentle poking at class distinctions. He doesn't seem to get satire as a form of humor, and he certainly, you can't imagine him watching television today and laughing at a lot of what's on there. Jon Stewart, I'm guessing, would just completely go over his head. So he's definitely shows his age here, and the gentleman is, what, in his 80s, I think, maybe.
Neil, in your review, you say when Paul Johnson describes more contemporary humor, he laments or rages against political correctness. What does he have to say there?
This comes right at the end of the book, and this is what he's well known for, is saying something provocative about whatever he's writing about, and it's provocative on the conservative, from the conservative end of the spectrum. And so in the final pages of this book, he delivers what to me was quite a wallop, and says essentially that in our age of political correctness, we've killed off a lot of the best sources of humor, like jokes about ethnicity and disabled people and black people. And that just made me kind of sit up in my chair after a relatively, you know, a sleepy sort of book. He hits you with that at the end.
And is he funny himself at all?
Not terribly, no. He has a nice eye for the odd personal details in people's lives and so on. And he's got the occasional fun turn of phrase. He's not really a laugh out loud funny type of guy. This is not what you'd get if Dave Barry had written this book about humorous, that he thought that would be a funny book from start to finish. This is an observational book about funny people.
Neil, you mentioned Paul Johnson's interest in bawdiness and bodies. Much sex humor here?
No, it's kind of odd in that he himself was involved in a bit of a sex scandal a decade or so ago, where his longtime mistress came out and claimed that they'd been having an affair for many years, and there was spanking involved and everything else. And he passes over a couple opportunities to sort of poke fun at himself here, especially in one chapter about that he calls "Bottoms Up." It's about Thomas Rowlandson, the artist, who tended to paint a lot of bare bottoms, but Mr. Johnson does not take the opportunity there to mention his own brush with scandal and maybe have some fun with it, because again, I don't think that's really in his makeup, the art of self-satire.
Do you think to be a really good humorist, Neil, you have to begin or end by making fun of yourself at some point?
I think so. I think the best humorists do that. You know, Mark Twain, for instance, could do that. The humorist today, Jon Stewart, again, is any given show of his, he's poking fun at a lot of people, but he'll also throw in a few self-deprecating remarks as well. And that's what you don't get from Paul Johnson. You don't get any self-deprecation. He would have had a better book if he'd had a little of that in there.
Thanks a lot, Neil.
You bet.
That's Neil Genslinger, who this week reviews Humorists, From Hogarth to Noel Coward, by Paul Johnson. Jennifer Schuessler's here with Bestseller News. Hi, Jenny.
Hi, Sam.
What's new on the list this week?
Nothing, Sam. Absolutely nothing. There are no new books. Tom Clancy, still on top of the fiction list with Dead or Alive. George W. Bush, who I think once said Dead or Alive about Osama bin Laden, still at the top of the nonfiction list with Decision Points. We've got Laura Hillenbrand, John Grisham, Stieg Larsson, James Patterson, Keith Richards, Jon Stewart. When are we going to be rid of these people? Ring out the old, ring in the new. Otherwise, we're going to have to cancel this segment.
This is Groundhog Day. It's the same thing over and over again. There are no new books at all?
Well, if I really want to grasp at straws, there is a sort of new old book at number 15 on the fiction list. Emma Donoghue climbs back onto the list with her novel Room. It was on a lot of year-end best lists, including ours. By coincidence, I was in touch with Emma Donoghue this week. Since I had nothing else to write about, I decided to ask authors who had bestsellers in 2010 if they were making any readerly resolutions in 2011. And here's what Donoghue had to say. She told me she was finally going to clean up her own room. She wrote, I'm going to clear my two double-stacked shelves of books to be read if it kills me. I'll proceed on Baconian principles, tasting many, swallowing most, chewing a few, and no doubt spitting a couple out.
That's what my daughter did when she was about 2 years old.
Yeah.
That's what she did with books. Any other resolvers have words of wisdom for you?
Well, I got a very sort of strongly worded list from Kathleen Shine. She had a bestseller earlier this year with The Three Weissmans of Westport. She had a bold 7-step plan. Number 1, stop reading mysteries obsessively like an addict. 2, stop pretending never to read mysteries. 3, read all of Hazel Holt's 19 mysteries in a row. 4, read Proust. 5, don't broadcast resolutions to read Proust all over New York the way every other person resolving to read Proust does. 6, no Trollope this year, not even one, even though, against all odds, there is an app for that. 7, download Trollope app.
So Kathy Shine falls on both sides of every question. Last year you asked authors the same question. Any follow-up report? Do you go back to any of those folks?
Well, I did. I promised I wouldn't, but I decided to break my promise. I got in touch with Alexander McCall Smith, who had another bestseller this year, The Double Comfort Safari Club, and I wanted to see if he had kept his rather bold promise to finally finish Vikram Seth's 1,400-page novel, A Suitable Boy. He swore he would finish it, and guess what, Sam? He didn't. But he doubled down. He told me that not only was he going to finish that book, he was going to get this finish Proust.
What about you, Jenny? Any resolutions?
Well, of course, I'm going to read Proust. But you know what? If that doesn't happen, maybe I will just read Kathy Shine and Alexander McCall Smith. In French, of course.
And hey, I have read Proust.
I know, Sam. I never stop hearing about it.
Thanks a lot, Jenny.
Thanks, Sam. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you. Thanks for listening. And remember, there's more at nytimes.com/books. You can tell us what you think of this show or any New York Times podcast by emailing podcasts@nytimes.com. I'm Sam Tannenhaus.